Hello, and welcome to Manga Splaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who have not read manga before. It's hosted by myself, David Brothers, Deb Aoki, Christopher Butcher, and Chip Zdarsky. Follow along with our reading list at mangasplaining.com. And I'll have our hosts introduce themselves, starting with Chris this time.
Hi, I'm Christopher Butcher. I've done lots of stuff in comics. Currently, I'm not doing too much. It's nice. I recommend it.
And Deb, how about you?
I'm Deb Aoki. I write about manga. I read a lot of manga. And I mostly talk about it on Twitter lately.
And Chip, who are you?
It's a great question. I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, 1975. Mm-hmm. I was a solitary child. Really kept to myself a lot. I'm a comic writer and artist of the North American variety, and I don't have a lot of experience with manga, and that's why I'm here.
Cool. And I'm David Brothers. I edit comics. I write about comics sometimes, though not recently, so I should probably stop saying that. And I'm here to host Mangasplaining Episode 2. This week's episode is all about a manga that I like a lot called Delicious in Dungeon by Ryoko Kui. It debuted in Japan in 2014, debuted in the US in 2017, thanks to Yen Press. And as of 2017, the first four volumes had over 2 million copies in print. So it's kind of a hit. Like, it seems like people like this one.
Wait, 2 million in Japan or 2 million in...
2 million in Japan. Ah. Yeah, 2 million US would be incredible.
2 million in Japan is a failure, right?
Yeah.
A failure.
Yeah, 2 million is kind of,
it's been canceled.
Kind of middle.
But this is food manga, which is something that gets talked about a lot in terms of when people discuss like the difference between manga and American comics or European comics. Is there's a long tradition of comics that are just about eating stuff or cooking stuff. And this one blends that with kind of a Dungeons and Dragons sort of setting. Like knights and wizards and thieves and such. We're going to find out how Chip feels, but before we get to him, I think I want to start with Deb this time. What do you think of Delicious in Dungeon?
I remember when I first saw it, it was at a bookstore in Japan, and I remember flipping through it and thinking, what a great concept, you know? It's about a bunch of adventurers, and they're going into this dungeon, and they decide that it's too much of a hassle, it's too hard for them to stay well-nourished and carry food in and stuff like that, and it's too expensive, they're not very rich. So they've come upon this idea that they are going to cook what they find in the dungeon. And it's kind of like how people deal with camping. Like, oh, why should I bring all these ready-to-eat meals when I could eat mushrooms that I harvest or fruit that I, you know, like when I'm hiking? Kind of like that, except this is way more sophisticated cuisine-wise. Yeah. I have to confess that I really only have read the first two volumes, and it seemed very much like this really, you know, like how a lot of manga starts out kind of high concept, and you think it's going to be like a one-note joke. Mm-hmm. And it basically starts out that way, where it's kind of episodic, where they decide they're going to eat what they find in the dungeon, and then they start cooking things like these mushroom people and these, you know, scorpions, and they make hot pot and stuff like that. And as someone who likes to cook, I can read this and think, oh yeah, yeah. I mean, the scorpion is kind of like lobster, and oh yeah, that mollusk, that when they're talking about this goo, it's kind of like jellyfish, you know. So you can kind of like reverse engineer it in your head, like what dish she is talking about me. And that's kind of fun, you know, because it's this weird hybrid of cooking and fantasy, and it's like, oh well, you know, like a lot of cooking manga, like What Did You Eat Yesterday, or I guess like Kitchen Princess, or like Food Wars. You can read it and think, oh, I could make that, they make it look so delicious, or they'll give you a recipe at the end. And so it kind of starts on that realm. It's very, the drawing's really cute, it plays upon the tropes of fantasy, like there's the magic user, there's the knight, there's the pickpocket, there's the troll and stuff like that, the dwarf, and the way that it puts it together is very clever, and the art is really charming. So when I first started, you know, taking pictures of it and showing it to people, all my, like, you know, Jim Zub, He writes Dungeons and Dragon. He immediately goes, oh my God, what is this? This is perfect. This is like this perfect Venn diagram of what he loves, because Jim loves to cook too, right? Oh, of course. And so when I saw it kind of like pick up when it came to America and I started, it kind of picked up, I thought, oh yeah, this is great. You know, this is great for American audiences because it doesn't, it's not super Japanese-y, but it's real, it's very original and different than what you expect from a fantasy comic.
And Chris, what was your first impression?
My first impression was actually in a Japanese bookstore in France, rather than Japan. I encountered this manga and I was like, what is this? The cover art looks like really lovely. Like it's really, and it doesn't look like a lot of traditional or contemporary manga covers. And I was flipping through and I'm like, oh my God, they're eating the monsters. They're playing Dungeons and Dragons and they're eating the monsters. Someone needs to translate this. And then like, 2 years went by and no one translated it. And that was really shocking to me. It seemed like such a slam dunk. It was just as Dungeons and Dragons had become sort of part of the cultural discourse again and was like ramping up in popularity. And I really like food manga in general, more so than is actually popular in the general populace. But yeah, I was really surprised it took a little over 2 years for it to be picked up or licensed and published by Yen, because it seemed like a slam dunk right off the bat for me. And then reading it, when it finally did come out, I was just, I love it. Like, I was in love with it. Such a good, high concept. And I actually really thought it was really, it really knocked it out of the park in a lot of ways in that first volume. But, you know, all of that said, I'm curious what Chip thought of it, rather than if I just keep going on and on about how good it is. Like, he comes in again and he's like, yeah. So those are my initial thoughts. David, I'm curious. I never thought this would be a manga you would actually pick because it's ongoing. First off, it's like a seinen manga. It's new. It doesn't have classic status like a lot of stuff. I'm really curious about this.
David has a type.
Yeah.
I definitely have. This is actually the least violent manga that I read, now that I'm thinking about it. But no, I wanted to do this one because it's a comedy manga. And I thought with Chip being a respected humorist in at least two different countries.
Whoa, nice.
That this would be kind of a cool way to both introduce him to like a side of manga he might not have seen before, but then also like to get feedback on like jokes, that kind of thing. So this might be a 5-minute podcast or a 45-minute podcast. But Chip, what did you think?
What the fuck? Was kind of the first thing. I should preface this by saying, like, not only is this podcast about me not having any experience with manga, I also have no experience with Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, me too.
I didn't know that.
I was actually going to ask about
that. Oh, really? Okay, yeah.
I thought it was a Canadian thing.
None at all. Yeah, like this is, you know, mentioning Jim before, this is a Jim Zub book, and it is not necessarily a book that would scream Chip Zdarsky. I did like it. I found it very funny and very horrifying. The beginning, the death of the mushroom.
Yeah. Oh, the mushroom was such a good introduction.
It really was. It was a very solid comedy introduction of just like the casual murder of this anthropomorphized mushroom. Yeah, no, it's charming. Like by the end of it, I was like, okay, I get it. Like Deb was saying, the episodic kind of nature of it. You know, every chapter was like, oh, let's a new ingredient. And I'm curious as to how it becomes an ongoing beyond this. Like, does it change and morph into a more serialized?
Kind of, actually. So, small spoilers for people who are listening, but obviously they rescue the sister. Chris was talking about this earlier.
And there's a pre-show, by the way. We don't record it yet. We're not famous enough to record our pre-show. But, you know, one day, if y'all like and subscribe, we'll do it. But yeah.
10,000 followers on Twitter, we'll give you the free show.
There you go.
But they rescue the sister, and best, as Chris said, like, she's not right when she comes back from being eaten by this dragon. And it kind of provides, like, more forward motion for the plot. It's still very much, like, let's eat this weird thing and tell jokes about it. But there's a lot more emotional payoffs and that kind of thing.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And I found the character of... Is it Marcel?
Yeah.
I was comedically, I enjoyed her the most, mostly because I didn't understand why her expressions were just so over the top at every moment. Like, I think part of it is me trying to figure out, like, is there a reveal coming? Like, is she a monster? And that's why she's just so, like, so upset at this.
I think just melodramatic.
Yeah. It's played up so much throughout that I just kept, like, I laughed whenever it happened, but I was also like, is there some sort of payoff beyond? And there's none.
It's
on is there
that,
none?
On that, not exactly. It's a little tropey in that she's the girl. So she's got to be squicked out the most by the things that are happening. It's just a manga trope.
Okay.
You've encountered a manga trope and butted up against it. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You are a new manga reader. But yeah, she has to be the, like, but she's also the reader identification character. Yeah. Like, yeah. You're talking about how it was funny, but also horrifying. That response is, like, closest to her, right?
Earlier in the book, when she says she's not a picky eater, and then they're like, oh, she's a type who says they're not picky.
See, I love that part because it reminded me of, like, all the people when you travel with a group of people.
Yeah.
There is a Marceline in your group, you know?
You can just say, David, Deb, I'm right here.
You don't know what? No.
No, you're fine.
You're super clear about what you will or will not eat. Like, that's fine.
Yeah.
Dealing with people who are like, oh, I'm fine. I don't really. Anyway.
I have so many weird dietary restrictions at this point in my life that I've just kind of gathered that I think that I'm the type of person that's okay with everything. So I always say that. I'm like, oh, no, I'll eat anything. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go somewhere. I'm like, oh, there's literally nothing for me to eat here.
Yeah.
I should have said something. I'm that person. I laughed a lot. That was probably my favorite moment in the book, actually.
Yeah. Like, it's such a charming, you said charming earlier, like, this is a very charming manga in general, I think, from the characters to the way the plot rolls out, even though they're on this life or death mission to rescue his sister. They're like, well, let's, like, take some time to make hot pot.
Yeah, it is very much not life or death. Like,
And the hot pot illustration is so cute, too, where they're on top of, like, a hand-drawn Dungeons & Dragons, like, grid map.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So good.
Yeah, the stakes in this there are no stakes in this.
Yeah.
Because they set up immediately the fact that the people die and come back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's no big deal. The second funniest part was just, it was the people that they rescued along the way. And then, like, later on, there's just this moment, like, oh, yeah, by the way, they died.
Like, they go through with a lot of very grim humor because, like, you can bring people back to life.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the kind of manga that I read when I don't want a super challenging time. Like, I don't want, like, the heart-rending emotional experience. I want, like, to laugh or to feel good for a little bit.
Like, I laughed probably the most when Senshi, the dwarf guy? Just when he's meticulously explaining everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he's like, and then we do this, and then we do this, and then we do this. I'm just like...
He's so
it's such a ludicrous
fact.
Idea. It's a matter of fact, and he gets really into it in a dungeon where there are monsters.
Yeah,
in which they have they have to be saving someone who's already been eaten by a dragon. Like, that's also the funny part. It's not that she's trapped down there, and we have to get her before she gets eaten by a dragon. Like, that's page
it's like
one.
We have to get
basically.
Her body.
Say, oh, don't worry, because, like, dragon's digestion is slow at night, so maybe she's still in the digestion process.
But they got a month.
That large ethical dilemma of when they get to the dragon, do they eat the dragon if the dragon has finished eating her?
Yeah.
Like, that's. That clicked into my vegan brain for sure.
Oh my god, are you really vegan?
Yeah. So I've been vegan for just almost a year, and so reading. But it's the kind of veganism where it's just like I want to eat cheese and I want to eat meat real bad.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not one of those ones who looks at it and goes, oh, that's disgusting. I'm just like, oh. So reading this, I'm just like, every meal, even if it was a fake meal. Mm-hmm. I'm still hungry for it.
Yeah. Part of the fun is the detail they go into with all of these fake ingredients and dishes. Mm-hmm. They treat it so seriously. The funniest part for me was a joke about the basilisk with the chicken being the tail. Yes. I don't know what it is about this joke, but it destroyed me the first time I read this book.
That was also very solid. Yeah.
Yeah. Chris, what was the funniest bit to you?
I loved that. Like the whole, yeah, the chicken. And then he actually, Chilchuck makes a chicken and the egg reference at the end, and it was so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually, you know what? I totally love, so after the main story's over, chapter 7, there's these little like one pagers that I would have ran once a month at the end. And those ones, I was like, I find those the funniest. Like those, I'm kind of dying every time. But when he, with the, honestly, the sword, when he like, he's like, oh my God, the sword's alive. He all named him Kensuke. And you're just like, you're a fucking psycho. Like this is actually like I know that these manga, need that, like, and we can talk about this, you know, a little later. I don't want to front load, but like, they need this like super driven personality if the whole manga is going to rest on them. But that I was just like, oh my fucking God, like he's not right either. This is great. Like,
well, he's not right at the beginning.
Yeah, no. From like, he's like, I've been in the maze so long that I mean, I couldn't help but think about eating all the things I'm killing. Haven't you? And they're all just like, yeah. What the fuck? Like, it's so, oh, they're so scared of him, but also so, like, on his team because he's got such passion. That's, again, super manga tropey, but I loved that. I loved all of that kind of stuff in the book.
Well, there's also that thing before they even go into the dungeons when he puts his hands on both of them. And like, you really intend to come with me no matter what? And it's so intense.
And they look at each other like, oh, well.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Deb, what joke worked the best for you?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I think the one that Chris mentioned is really great. You know, the part where it's like the sword, like he looks at the sword, it's alive. He's like, I'm not gonna tell anybody. I'm so into this. It's kind of, I mean, the parts that are just really charming about this is like, oh, just the faces. I mean, there's that one scene where she just Marceline's face when she's like. Oh, the part where she gets eaten by this man-eating plant, and then the guy goes, "The way they wrap around you, it must have felt really good." And she looks at him like, "What the hell?"
I think I've seen people. There you go. I've seen people using this as like their Twitter avatar and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like that pure level of shock and dismay. So good.
As a girl, I kind of felt it like, you know, like when you've had like guys tell you stuff like that and you're like, are you effing kidding me?
Yeah.
I could feel that.
Yeah.
And these little bits like Lyos being a weird creepy psychopath or Marcel being a very picky eater, they kind of turn into like emotional beats down the line. Like, Lyos's passion and obsession kind of comes back on him a little bit, but he also keeps making stupid decisions because he wants to eat things so, so bad.
Yeah. I like just the fact that he, you know, he plays it cool, but he's actually a psychopath. And Senshi is such a great character. The introduction is so good. Like, that drawing is just, like, perfect. It's, like, weird, creepy statue of a being, but later on when he keeps fucking up the traps,
it was so good.
Chilchuck, like it's good to see that, because that character seems like they've got it all kind of together throughout until that point. Then all of a sudden they're just like this bubbling oaf. I thought that was really smart.
That's actually, and it's pretty slick that in one volume you get this dynamic between these four characters, these four introductory characters, that is almost like Seinfeld. Like, they're so well-defined, you know?
Okay, yeah.
and the way that they bonk, they bounce off each other, and, like, it's a real art to create characters that are so different, distinct.
Yeah.
And then the way that they mesh with each other and bounce off each other and irritate each other, or the way that she established a running joke, like she set the premise of these characters and how they would bump, you know, it's like have friction with each other or get put in situations and then something crazy would happen or they would react a certain way. I think it's very clever because it's really hard to write characters like that, you know, and have them all mesh together in a way that seems effortless.
I was wondering about that. And is she playing on D&D tropes?
So yeah, I played D&D as a kid a lot, like a lot. And then, you know, all the fantasy role-playing games that go with it and stuff like that. I kind of quit at a certain point and moved on to cyberpunk things, although I haven't played the game yet. But yeah, so a lot of this was absolutely like by the book Dungeons and Dragons starting point stuff, which I actually really enjoyed. I loved how much D&D was in this and the different, you know, all the food stuff aside, little things like the core concept is food is expensive and food is heavy and it's too hard to carry too much food into the dungeon. Oh, they're playing with third edition encumbrance rules, which they've massaged later on, because no one wants to keep track of how much all the equipment their character's carrying actually is. Yeah, it's not fun to play where you have to like weigh everything, because it wouldn't be fun in real world, right? Like where you've actually can only carry 7 days of food if you're going to go on an adventure that's 2 weeks or whatever. So like little things like that I thought were really, really good. Everyone fucking hates encumbrance.
Especially third edition encumbrance. Am I right, everyone? Yeah, am I right?
You're like rope.
Yeah.
3 gold pieces or like 3 silver pieces, 0.5 pounds, and you have to keep track of all. Anyway, whatever.
That sounds like horrible math to have to deal with when you're playing a game.
People are doing it a little bit less. That's why Bag of Holding was the best item in the game.
Bag of Holding.
Carry whatever you wanted forever.
I get a bag of holding when I go to Japan.
Because
when you go shopping, you got to carry everything everywhere all day.
It's a bag that anything you can physically fit into the opening of the bag will go into the bag forever. And when you reach in, you just have to think of what you want and you'll pull it out. Bag of holding. It's a magic item in D&D. It's the best magic item in D&D. Anyway, and it's less problematic than Wish. Sorry, this is getting real deep.
No, that's what this is for.
We're doing a podcast, so
D&D podcast.
I really loved that about it. The other thing I wanted to call out before I get to my larger point, because why get to the point, right, is every time they do a recipe in the book. They have it starts off as a pentagram where it shows how many calories, how much fat, how much salt. And then about halfway through, it changes to a 6-pointed thing where it shows the sort of stat sheet. I'm trying to find. Oh, here we go. So it shows the sort of stat sheet situation where you can see on the 6-pointed thing, like how much of each thing it values like how much value it has. And that's a like, not only is that like 5-pointed thing, which is, I think, why they had to change it to 6-point, because D&D is really trademarked out the ass, but that kind of power chart is very big in role-playing games in general and that kind of stuff. So I thought it was a really good addition. It's using food manga tropes, the like beauty shot of a piece of food, you know what I mean? And it's using D&D tropes at the same time, sort of overlaid onto each other. So it's synthesizing the two things in a way that's really good. Like that beautiful product shot is in every food manga where you like, they finally prepare the dish and we get the like perfect Instagram shot, we call it now. But then they're adding the like ingredients, which you might include, but the ingredients and their like values and things like that. And then like their stats, which is kind of Scott Pilgrim-y in a way, which I like. That's where Brian pulled it from RPGs as well, where all the like soft drinks and Scott Pilgrim give you stat bonuses and things. So it's like, she's really working on a level where she's synthesizing so many different things and making it really work on the page, I think. Like, it's very successful at what it's trying to do. But I do feel like the first volume is aiming real mid, and that's maybe what I wanted to, like, it's, you know, it does really build into something else as it goes. It starts off super comfortable. And I think that's, you know, that's something I want to talk about as well, is characters. I'm not hosting this week.
I noticed people were talking about the latest version of Dishes and Dungeon came out, I guess, fairly recently. And
Volume 9 just came out,
people were talking about, like, oh my God, it's come out. Like, oh, they're so excited, you know, like, like, oh, I want to read this. Oh, I want to see what happens next. I thought, did this story change since I last read it?
I think it's one of those ones where it got a pretty... also, I didn't realize the new volume came out, like, today.
Oh, is it today? Oh, wow. Yeah. A lot going on today.
Right? I think it's one... It was so charming and different that it got a lot of really dedicated fans in the U.S. Like, really evangelistic fans.
Well, it's also, it was Biden's first order, right?
We all had to talk about it.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, yeah.
But that happens actually, in manga, right? That, like, something starts out fairly high concept, and mm-hmm. it starts out a certain way because, you know, it's basically like the first episode of a series. And then as it gets more successful in the story, it goes on and on. It changes. Like, I remember when I first read One Piece, like, the first couple volumes, like, I thought, what is this, you know? And, and then everyone said, no, keep going, keep going. After volume 10, it'll hit this point where there's this point with Nami's story that you'll go, oh, that's why.
People saying that is why people hate manga. Because you're just like, no, you got to read the first $100 worth to get to where it gets pretty good, actually.
It sucks. Well, sorry. Well, yeah.
I think that's the case with a lot of, like, long-running series, right? Like, it starts off, like, we talk about the high concept, but, like, the writer, artist, the cartoonist, like, must get bored at a certain point. Like, I thought this was fun, but also, like, towards the end, I'm just like, do they do this for the rest of their lives? Like, what is it? Like, where it's like another chapter, oh, we're a bit deeper, and I guess we're eating this now. Here's the recipe. Like, it's fun to a point, but when you're creating something like that, like, it naturally has to go elsewhere. Like, let me preface this by saying I've never read Cerebus.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I love where this is going already.
I think that's hard with
had
long series.
I had volume one, and I tried to read it, and it was given to me by this girl on a date, like, oh, you got to read Cerebus, and I just didn't care for it. Mm-hmm. But my understanding of it is that it changes. It starts off as a parody comic and then changes and becomes like a deeper and ultimately not very good thing. Mm-hmm. But that seems like a natural thing for comic writers and artists to do once they've kind of like gone through the tropes and the, you know, the repetition of the things that,
I think sometimes you have like a really good idea, you just have to get out, and then you have to figure out how to make it work after.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of first volumes of manga, especially ones like this that are kind of gimmicky from our perspective, they'll be like the first volume's like, here's all the types of jokes we're going to do. And then they keep adding in more and more plot or story or emotional resonance, for lack of a better. Like, One Punch Man is another manga. It's super good. It has one joke, which is that one guy trains so hard he can punch anything and destroy it in, like, one hit. And there's, like, 15 volumes of it now.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I've got to get you to read One Punch Man.
It's genuinely great because of the way they change it up. That one is so good.
You know how long it took me to realize people were actually talking about a character named One Punch Man, and they were not talking about Batman punching Guy Gardner?
One Punch. Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
One of the things I was really interested in reading this, it got me started to think about my own creative process. And it's funny you mentioned Mal Scott Pilgrim and how, you know, I think there's similarities here where he took things that he loved, like RPG video games, superhero stuff, slice of life, and put them together into a thing that really worked as a result. And it's the same thing here where it's like the cartoonist loves Dungeons and Dragons and loves food. Like, those shouldn't really work together, but because they love them both so much and it comes through in the story, it works. And like, I'm not a foodie, and I'm not clearly a Dungeons and Dragons guy, but I still enjoy it because the love of the material comes through to me as a reader. And so it makes me think, like, well, what are the things I enjoy that I can turn into my next comic? Because I'm thinking a lot about that right now. Like, what, I'm done drawing sex criminals. Like, what's the next thing I'm going to draw? And I'm like, what are the things I love? And I love comics.
Didn't you just announce a new series like yesterday?
Oh, I'm always announcing new series, but whatever. I love comics and I love sex, but we just did that. Like, what else do I love? What do I love? So it sent me into a bit of a spiral.
Yeah.
That I don't actually have hobbies or interests.
Oh, I think comics are really good for finding creators who are obsessed about things or interested in things, because the distance between creation and like consumption is so thin.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this fun for me. Because like you, like I don't know anything about Dungeons and Dragons outside of like the arcade game I never beat when I was a child.
Yeah, you and I are really cool. That's yeah,
right? We were too busy, you know, like talking to girls and driving cars and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Dungeons and Dragons made me gay. I don't even know.
Like, that I didn't know.
No, it really didn't. It was
bag of holding.
Then.
What does that mean?
Right?
Holding.
But it's one of those things where it's cool to see something through someone else's eyes. Yeah. And in this case, like, it's clear that what makes Dungeons and Dragons fun is like the community and also getting to goof off during your big world-ending apocalyptic story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I feel like half of the like RPG jokes I see are someone going off to like beat Sauron, but stopping to like run a bar or hit on a bartender or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you bring that up because that's D&D is so rigid. Like it's this setting, right? Like you're supposed to give you rules. D&D is just a set of rules for how you're supposed to act within this sort of tabletop gaming performance experience. But the fun of it comes from pushing at the edges of it. And like using it as a starting point and going beyond it. And you see that with a lot of the big D&D renaissance that happened, especially in indie comics in the last couple of years, is people that like start with the rules, but then, you know, go so far beyond them, especially because, you know, D&D is literally just taking a bunch of Tolkien ideas and giving them stats. It's Tolkien for stat nerds. And then trademarking the hell out of it so no anyone who came afterwards had to pay them money. No. Tolkien had a lot of problems in his work. Like there is like some real racism in Tolkien's work that like mostly got glossed over in the movies, which is good. And I will say I wanted to read volume 1 and 2 just to see, I've read the series up to volume 7, I think. I wanted to read volume 1 and 2 just to see if the second volume was specifically different. And yeah, right in the second volume, it starts to get a little bit more real, like in that it gets a little bit deeper, especially with the introduction of the orcs, which is like a non-friendly, we're all getting along and adventuring the island race of characters. And orcs, again, hugely problematic when they come from Tolkien, really portrayed in a very different way in here that I think works pretty well. Mm-hmm. Also, the orc man on the back of this volume is hot and could get it.
I see.
Yeah, they start, I think in the second volume, they start building a little bit. But that was actually my main question. Chip, did you care about any of the characters? Were you like, I'm invested in them? Or was it just too light on the kind of character moments that are a hallmark of your work, frankly?
I don't think I'm at the point with one volume where I care about the characters. Like, they're there to entertain me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, there's nothing... Yeah, I don't think I do. Anyways, like I might be surprised if I started volume 2 and I'm like, oh, these characters, I need to see what happens now to them. Like I'm interested enough that, unlike Akira, I actively want to read volumes 2 through 6. With this one, I think it'd be more of if I was in a bookstore and I saw it, I'd flip through it and go, okay, yeah, I'm gonna pick up volume 2.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Or if I'm in a specific mood to do that. The only real downside to volume 1 for me, I think the art falls down a lot in places. And I do find that hard to get by. Maybe because the bar was set so high with Akira with our last episode. That all I'm seeing in this are kind of shortcuts and sometimes some weakness in perspective shots of people and line weights and stuff. Like, it feels very much a young artist who maybe didn't have a lot of training, but has a lot of heart, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the cartooning didn't speak to me as much as the humor did. Like, the cartooning seemed like just a way to get to the jokes and the really nice food shots. So there are some really lovely panels in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the inking, the line weight, like, really falls apart for me because it's so sporadic in the quality.
Kind of building on that, like, structural kind of thing, this is the first one we've done that has Japanese sound effects for you, right?
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Was that at all
That's
jarring?
How Yen Press does things.
And I read them all perfectly.
Yen Press has a thing where they'll keep the original Japanese, but they'll put what it says in tiny English text.
Yeah. It took me a little bit to understand what was going on, what that was. But then I realized, oh, okay, that's letting me know what the sound effect means. Mm-hmm. And they were funny. Like, the sound effects were kind of used for comedy, which I appreciated.
Mm-hmm. But you can see how they're really integrated into the art. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, some of them you could take out with no problem, but some of them are very, very emotive, expressive kinds of lettering. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The English over top of it was awkward in a lot of spots. Mm-hmm. Somebody needs to really let this letter understand what tangents are.
Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of spots where it's just like going perfectly into a head or something. Like, it's following the lines of characters and background. Stuff like that always jars me, but I love the Japanese lettering. The other thing for me, this is one of the first times where I've read the right to left.
Yeah, that, I wanted to ask you about that too.
Oh, that's right. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Ah. Yeah. Yeah. I've had to do it a couple of times in the past, but yeah, it takes a while for my head to kind of get around that.
You know what I realized is whenever I see a black and white American comic, I try to read it manga style first.
Do you really?
I was wondering that. Like, I could see how you could just be like, by the end, I was like so into it, it wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
But I could see how you could get used to it. Sorry, I just find it weird scanning right to left, but then I have to travel all the way across the words and start. Because that's still left to right, so your brain's kind of like constantly doing this back and forth loop.
Well, you've encountered your first North American manga trope, which is all translation is compromise. None of it is perfect ever. If you want the perfect version, learn Japanese.
And even then, I probably won't learn it well enough for it to be perfect.
Not for a couple years. Yeah.
The structural side, like the word balloon shapes the way, like so few balloons have tails that are pointing at people.
Yeah.
It's so different from American comics for me.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. That I love. I actually prefer that. And when I was lettering comics, I would try to get away with as short a tail as they would let me do, or even inverted. And on two projects, they made me go back and change all of them to look more American. And it was just like a horror show because it looked right to me. But, you know, got to do what the editor says.
I mean, this comic in particular is very cramped. And so you don't really need tails.
No.
Because they're kind of squished into things.
Yeah.
I will say that I flipped through volume 6, which is the other volume that I have, and her art has smoothed out a lot.
Oh, yeah?
Her art is much better than it was in earlier volumes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say there's a noticeable change. Like David was saying in the intro, the first volume actually did really, really well. It sold like 300,000 copies when it was released. When you get that kind of money and that kind of attention, you can hire a few more assistants. And also, you know, just like by the time she gets to volume 6, she's drawn more than 1,000 pages of this manga, right? Like, these are 230 page plus volumes. Mm-hmm. She's a much, much better artist in volume 6, but it's building on, she doesn't lose any of her strengths. Her character designs, God, I love her character designs so much. And as she introduces more characters, they still remain really unique and interesting. She's introducing a lot of different body styles and things like that. It's not just like skinny American, you know, whatever characters, which I really like. Everyone's really cute. But other than that, even the like creepy monsters that have human faces are adorable. But I really like
the dead healer that was swallowed by the plant was really funny looking.
Yeah, so so good. But her art, I think it's the kind of thing where I think if you stuck with it, you would actually be really, really impressed by some of the things that they do later on with the artwork, especially with the, when they're actually having that, I guess this is just for David, that when they're having the chase with the red dragon and they're going through all of the different twists and turns of the catacomb at like the different levels in this castle, I was never lost. I thought that was really, really well done. The perspective was all on point. But I also kind of felt like, the assistants blue-lined all that out for her. And that's it. That's the way it worked. This is a monthly series, which is like 28 pages a month in Harta magazine, which is like, honestly, Kadokawa's best magazine. It's so good. It's so pretty. I think I think that's the way it goes. Like, oh, you've proven yourself a hit. Great. Here you go. Here's all the resources you could want. But what before that happens, you're kind of, you know, you're out on your own a little bit. So I think your art worries for people who are like really into the, like who look at the first issue cover, first volume cover issue cover and go, oh, I like this image. And then are kind of let down by the interiors. It definitely gets to that point, probably around volume three. All of a sudden it's like, she's got some experienced help. And she, I think, is getting stronger as an artist for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, like it, like I think a lot of it is in the computer side of things. I guarantee this is drawn on computer because there are some scenes where it looks like she's zoomed in to draw it, and some scenes where it looks like she's pulled back out to draw it, and so like tiny details that are getting weirdly lost, and then big things that are kind of clunky.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's the kind of thing like some artists get past it, some artists don't get past it. And it's nice to know that she does get past it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be interested to see the later volumes to see the art change.
Well, if you ever can ever go in a store again, you should pick up a copy and flip through it.
Yeah.
Deb, how does this rate about against other foodie mangas for you?
As far as being able to cook from it,
or just in terms of being entertaining?
Being entertaining. For me, a food manga makes you hungry is successful. Mm-hmm. This one doesn't quite do that, but it's fun because you can see a lot of cooking principles in it. Like when I read say even Drifting Dragons, for example, which is a little similar but different, where there's a main character who is just hell bent on eating any critter he can get his hands on. But the food is more grounded in actual cooking. Like, I could take any of those dragon recipes, change it into beef, and I could make those recipes. With these, I can't. Like, you know, like the scorpion and mushroom hot pot. It's like,
yeah,
no, I don't think that's gonna work.
So, sorry, this is my naive
no man, that's why we're here,
non-manga question, but so food manga, is it generally towards the idea that people are cooking from, like, is it half recipe book, half story?
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of them are.
Is it a recipe book kind of disguised as story?
I would say like 80-20 story recipe book.
Yeah, okay. it's a driver because, like, you know, it's kind of cruel, right? Because the way the cooking is done, the ingredients, the preparation style is a driver of the story, and it leads up to this climax, which is the finished dish that you look at and go, ooh, looks good. So it all seems kind of mean to not tell you how to make it, right? you're curious. So that's what the premise is, that it's like, oh, you know, it's helps you to make it. But there's also food manga that has nothing to do with making it later. Like, for example, Drops of God, which is a wine manga, is about appreciating wine. And it does spotlight real wines that you can purchase, but it's not about cooking. Or
for a more contemporary one, there's Shogeki no Soma, which is called Food Wars in North America. And that's all like real cooking techniques that you would use, but at like a high level. So it's like showing you, like, you know, how to make top-notch cuisine, but it doesn't actually prepare the recipe. It walks you through the steps you would need to make it without giving you like amounts and ingredients or like etc. But then the other food manga will be like very much just recipe manga, where the characters will be like, oh, so now I'm going to take 15 milliliters of mirin cooking and I'm going to put that, and, you know, like walk you through, what did you eat yesterday is a good example of that, where each chapter has like a full recipe that you can follow, and it's the recipe is explained using manga panels. And I think there's food manga is a pretty wide genre, and that's just food manga that's about cooking. Some of it's about eating. I know one of Deb's favorites is Wakozake, which is just about a lady who goes to a bar and gets wasted and eats bar food and gets drunk on, and so every episode is like a different delicious drink and a different delicious food, and it's so good. So
sometimes,
good.
Yeah, sometimes the food manga is just teaching you how to appreciate what goes into making these dishes.
That's a good way to look at it.
You know, like Silver Spoon, for example, is about a kid at a farm school, and they get into how they make cheese, and then they make pizza, and how they make bacon. you know, and then they don't, she never walks you through, and you know, like a end page, like here's a recipe on how you can kill your own pig and make bacon. It's just kind of built into the story, but it's just, it teaches you something, you know?
Is there like a North American equivalent? Like it's interesting because like comics are often talked about as like a way to get kids to learn how to read. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, and also like in wartime, you know, dropping comics down onto like battlefields or whatever, like even if you don't understand the language, you can like learn a thing from it. Mm-hmm. Like to surrender, I guess. But is there any North American comics that are like designed to basically teach you something while telling the story? Like I always equate that with like kid stuff. Like,
yeah.
Like we're teaching you a lesson or we're teaching you how to tie your shoes in this kid's book. So the fact that there's like this higher level adult stuff, because some adults don't know how to cook or some adults are looking for new recipes. Yeah. Like, that's amazing to me. And like, I can't think of anywhere else where that comes into play.
I think the approach is different in North America. Like Lucy and Isley does cooking comics, but they're like comics about cooking instead of being an adventure comic where cooking happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that distinction, I think it's because like you could make a manga about anything and have a reasonable chance of success because of how the industry's set up, and it's less so here.
Yeah.
There's a willingness to be ridiculous in manga that I think holds a lot of American comics back.
Like I could probably turn Daredevil into a cooking comic.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah. He's all about amazing. He's all about his senses.
Oh yeah,
he's in Hell's Kitchen. Mm-hmm.
So this is an example of a comic that's come out. I want to say fairly recently, but you know, like 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago now. But this was kind of revelatory when it was released. It's Cook Korean by Robin Ha. And it's published by, I think it's a Simon & Schuster imprint. It was about Robin teaching you in recipe form, Korean recipes, mm-hmm. in comics form, sorry, Korean recipes, working with her mom, exploring her Korean heritage. So it had graphic novel elements to it. It had recipe elements to it. It was like an illustrated cookbook. It would have different kinds of short comic stories introducing things. So I think it's changing for sure. Mm-hmm. I think Japan and even Europe to a certain extent were ahead of the curve on comics that don't just have to be, you know, serials, like stories that don't also sort of impart knowledge or like even nonfiction comics in North America, like what we think of as nonfiction comics in North America are almost exclusively autobio or memoir or biography. You know what I mean? Whereas I think the it's a lot wider outside of North America. I've got a Paris travel book, like a travel guide to Paris, that's by French cartoonists, not Rupert and Malot, the other famous team, but I've got a Parisian travel guide that's by French cartoonists that they were hired. Penelope Bejeu is another French cartoonist who did a travel guide that was published by Lonely Planet, and it's comics. It's like a comics travel guide to a place as comics. Those are huge in Japan too. There's tons and tons of them. So this is like, you know, it's interesting that we're starting here because I could give you like Oishinbo or something, which is really just like about the food and about the cuisine. Mm-hmm. But I think David picked a really interesting title actually for you in that it has all of those elements of what we think of as cooking comics, but is also an adventure serial. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really key.
Yeah. I agree. I am pretty smart sometimes.
So smart.
I remember when I first saw this book, I thought to myself, this is a natural for people who don't normally read manga because it's so approachable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like Dungeons and Dragons, but they eat the fucking continuity. Monsters.
It's so approachable and yet so different from what you can get in America, right? So it's kind of fresh that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chris mentioned Food Wars earlier, another cooking manga, and how it's all very like high class. Like when you cut open an omelet, like the glistening egg makes the moon like sparkle in your eyes kind of a thing. But in the collections, they include like the poor people's version of that recipe. Mm-hmm. So if you want to make it at home, you can use your like trashy Safeway ingredients to get a similar effect.
No, have you ever tried making any of the recipes? Because I don't think I have.
It's still like a little bit above my class. Like when people talk about knife techniques, I'm like, I'm already out. Like, what do you do besides cutting, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what did you eat yesterday? Like, for example, I think the original translator was not so food savvy, not so cooking savvy.
Yeah.
So it was hard to Like you couldn't cook with it. But I think in latter volumes they changed translator, and the translator is much more food savvy and much more Japanese food savvy. So I could,
makes sense. The translator in the later volumes is Jocelyn, by the way, who you
that's
know.
Right. Yes. Jocelyn Allen. I remember she was very proud of taking that on. Because originally when I first picked up What Did You Eat Yesterday, that's not a blank kind of pepper. That's a blank kind of pepper, and it's very different. And if you didn't know that and you tried to cook with it, it's not going to work. But
localization is hard.
Yeah, it's unless you know it, you know, it's there's
yeah.
That's a degree of difficulty with Japanese translating Japanese manga, right? For example, like Haikyuu. If you don't know volleyball terminology and how people talk about volleyball, you're going to have a hard time translating it.
So we are at about 50-ish minutes of talking about Delicious and Dungeon. I think we figured out how charming and interesting and great I am for recommending this.
Yep.
We're going to take a short break for sponsorship, a little bit of music, and then we'll get back with recommendations. So welcome back. This next part is where we choose the next book we're going to inflict on Chip. Or I guess where Chip chooses the next book we're going to inflict on him.
Yeah, come on. Yeah.
Chris, kick us off. What do you have to recommend for our friend Chip?
David, you have so thoroughly inspired me. I started this project thinking, I'm only going to recommend standalone graphic novels, something that's closer in format to things that Chip is already comfortable with, let's say. More comfortable with.
You make me sound like I'm a newborn babe in the woods and you don't want to frighten me.
More like a
little bit. I'm a grown man who's versed in comics.
Sure, you said that you would go along with this, but also if too many complicated things in a row, and maybe you would be like, this was an interesting 6 episodes of a podcast, I'm out. So I wanted to pick something that would be you could find a beginning, middle, and end. But I think, this was such a good recommendation, Delicious and Dungeon, because it is such a good gateway for people who have, specific interests that aren't necessarily manga to read manga. And it's the tropes weren't too heavy. You weren't too put off by them, which is good. Just good, because it gets heavier later. So I wanted to recommend my other favorite. Delicious and Dungeon is actually top 2 my favorite ongoing series right now. And I was also, that's another reason I was really happy that David picked it. I love it because I call them meatloaf manga. You just want a comfort food fucking manga, which is just lovely. And even when it tenses up a little bit later, it's a good tense up. It's I got to the pepper and the meatloaf, not, I can't deal with the fucking crushing despair of the world. So that's good. So I want to take my other manga that I really love, which balances those things, is way more intense, is Golden Kamuy. Which is really shiny, actually. I'm getting your whole screen on there. Golden Kamuy by Satoru Noda, published by Viz Media. And we should mention translators too. David, that was a good note that you made. The translator, I cannot find their name, but here we go. Translated by Eiji Yasuda, and published by Viz Media. And so Golden Kamuy has an amazing tagline. This is a series that could 100% be an image book or a boom book, where it's, you're selling it based solely on this one sentence, and then if the comic actually follows up on it, you're good. The sentence is, this guy has got to earn enough money back to buy back a farm. Because he made a battlefield promise that he would take care of his best buddy's wife and buy back her farm, and so she could live out a comfortable life and she wouldn't have to sell herself. Because it's the 1800s, it's the Russian-Japanese War, real war story. And he finds the best way to do this and earn this money is by finding a treasure map from money that was misallocated during the war to find this huge treasure of gold. And the map is tattooed onto the back of 100 escaped convicts that he has to track down across all of Hokkaido and mainland Japan and fucking get these pieces of the map. It's so good. It's so good.
And it's about cooking, too.
I love. So the other thing that I like about it, too, is that it takes place. It's in the, like, I think, yeah, mid to late 1800s in Hokkaido, just after it's been annexed and, like, settled, air quotes, settled by mainland Japan. And they did some, they have a similar history to Canada in some ways, where they did some not great stuff with the native peoples, the Ainu of Hokkaido. So the Ainu are still very much like a living, you know, breathing society, not just, you know, now how they are treated as like an extinct society, which is also not true. Mm-hmm. So it's this soldier who was like a brutal soldier on the war, dealing with the Ainu people, as well as the first escaped convict, as like a triumvirate of people who are after this gold, but for like these deeply altruistic reasons. And they're only hunting down convicts, so it kind of works out okay. Like, they become really good anti-heroes. But you learn so much about survivalism, about Ainu culture. There's so much Ainu culture in this, to the point where I made a point to go to the Ainu Museum in Hokkaido last time I was in, or two times ago when I was in Japan, because I wanted to learn more, you know, and see these artifacts that I'd seen lovingly detailed, just like the food is lovingly detailed in real life. So for me, Golden Kamuy is like probably the best action comic coming out right now. And to be fair, I haven't read every single action comic coming out right now, but the action is so good. It is deeply funny as well.
It's
it is
so funny.
Really, really funny. And it fucking earns its mature rating on the back, and not in the ways that most contemporary manga sadly earn them. It earns it by being like really realistic and fucking brutal. So I love this book, and I hope, even if we don't get to choose it next time, I hope we get to choose it in the future. The only problem is it's ongoing. It's at 20 volumes.
It's 20 volumes.
Yeah, it's at 20. I think in Japan, I think it's even pretty close to that in North America.
Is it spoilers for me to ask how many convicts have been taken care of by volume 20?
That's not really important.
I lost count.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry,
it's not how many dead convicts you have. It's the journey.
It's the journey.
It's the quality.
It's the quality of the dead convicts.
That was quite a recommendation.
It's the corpses
you gather
along the way.
Sorry, I love this series. I've like recommended it on stream and stuff before, so I was ready for this one.
Why do you say it's quite a recommendation?
That was just very thorough and compelling.
And the twists just absolutely batshit. Like, yeah. I've never seen an action comic that has twists like this. Where you're like, yeah. What? God, what? How did that happen?
That's a great recommendation, Chris. I'll take it under consideration.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Deb, what is your recommendation?
I'm going to go with the two and see what resonates. One is one that I think a lot of people are known, you know, as Way of the House Husband. It won an Eisner Award for comedy. And it's basically about a Yakuza, a retired Yakuza. He's like a legendary, like the immortal dragon, like this brutal mobster. But somehow he finds himself in this situation where he is now a house husband. And he still talks like a gangster. He still acts like a gangster. But he's kind of like dealing with the new challenge, the new thing to be good at, which is how to make bento box lunches, how to vacuum the floor, how to outsmart his cat. So it's really funny.
I believe this is Vin Diesel in The Pacifier.
Actually.
So this is this was really fun to, it's a fun read, like you'll laugh out loud. It's going to be adapted by Netflix as an anime. I think it's coming out next month. So it's going to get even hotter.
Oh, wow.
Really happy to see a lot of people pick up on this.
And now, is that an ongoing series?
It's only up to, I think, volume 5.
Okay, it's only up to volume 5.
Yeah, only 1,000
pages. And it's episodic, like, you know, as things go on and more gangsters come in and more mm-hmm. ridiculous things happen. But it's you can read just one volume and not feel like you're missing out on a lot of story.
Sounds pretty good.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
The other one.
Save your next one. Don't give them all away.
Okay.
I think I'll save it. It's unfair to Chris too.
I'll save it for next time.
No. I don't mind actually if Chris you recommend is, like, to. I talked so long about that first one. Deb's got to catch up. So.
Oh, I'll just bring it up because we were just talking about it during the break, and I'll just show it to you.
All right.
Yeah.
But it's called What the Font. It's basically a manga where all the different fonts are people. So the main character is Helvetica, and then he meets Bodoni, who is very artsy and avant-garde, and then there's Gotham, and then it goes into the history of the fonts, and they all have different personalities, and how they're similar but different, and it shows how...
Is Comic Sans in there? Comic Sans?
Yes! Comic right, Sans is in there. Comic Sans is a real nerd.
Nice.
All right. I would have pictured them uglier, but go on.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, it does go into the history of the fonts and where the fonts are.
That feels like it's not an ongoing. Am I correct?
It's one volume only.
Okay. I mean, they're always making new fonts, so.
But it's good, true. It's That's a good true. Overview of fonts. So if you ever went to art school or design school, you'll recognize a lot of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, I don't know how to live up to those recommendations with mine now. But mine is, it's a manga called Again with 2 exclamation points by Mitsuru Kubo. And essentially there's this genre in Japanese manga where people fall down and die and wake up in another universe as a different person. Or sometimes they time travel to the past and like, it's like, oh, I have to be myself again. Only now I have like my adult human brain. This is one of those. Where a guy graduates from high school or is graduating, falls down and wakes up as a freshman again. And he's like, oh, this is my chance to have friends.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So he kind of manipulates people into being his friends, but through doing that, learns the meaning of friendship. But the way he does this is by joining essentially a cheer squad, like the people who go to sports games or events and like kind of hypes up the crowd. Mm-hmm. And goes places you would not expect from, you know, like a dumb time travel story. And it's actually 12 volumes deep right now.
It ends at 12.
It ends at 12? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right.
But it's one of those ones, like, really heartfelt, really emotional, and also really funny. Like, it plays with its, like, time travel gimmick quite a bit. But it's another kind of manga trope that I'm excited to introduce you to.
Damn. So, I mean, I want to read all of these. Like, I don't know if we've actually quite figured out how we're doing this.
No, yeah. one wins, the rest die. We're making it up as we go along. We could go back. You just got to choose one. We're hoping, I'm hoping, that you will come to see things that you like in manga, and that'll help you choose what the next book is, but it's still pretty early days. This is only a second episode, so.
I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, what the font sounds the most interesting. Mm. And I feel like that's something like I just couldn't get in a North American comic.
Yeah.
Like, at all. It's just such a wild idea. Like the other books are like, okay, I could almost picture them as like maybe an Image series, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that one is so out of left field that I think that might be my number one pick right now.
All right, we're doing What the Font. Who published that one, Deb?
Seven Seas.
Seven Seas? I think I know people at Seven Seas. Maybe we can get copies. Let's ask.
Yeah.
But I want to do the other ones as well. So like maybe that's the first one and then we randomize the other three.
How about Golden Kamuy after that? Because that would be so different.
Yeah.
We just recommended 3 books in a row that are all at least, well, and Deb's original first recommendation that are all so many volumes too. So yeah, maybe a couple standalones is not a bad idea.
Yeah.
Maybe we can come back. Well, yeah, let's figure it out. But for now, we're definitely doing What the Font. So next episode is Deb's pick, which is Mermaid Saga, 2 volumes from Viz. I don't know if we're just doing volume 1 or both of them, but I'm going to read them both because why not?
Yeah, same here.
Next up is my pick, which was Helter Skelter by Kyoko Okazaki, which I'm very excited about. That one's going to fuck your shit up. That'll be good.
That's a one volume, so that's good.
And then and that's only one volume. It's pretty short, but it's good. And then after that, it's what the font. So so next episode, let's get back into, you know, I think it'd be fun for me to try and recommend Golden Kamuy to you every single week until you finally pick it.
Every
single week.
We'll make it sound better and better every week.
You know, I know we're just solving how to do our podcast while doing the podcast, but I do feel just like one of you should just recommend something every week.
And we just instead of the recommendation.
Because like, yeah, like
oh, the ones like, that, like take away your choice.
Well, yeah, yeah, because the ones that David and Chris recommended are great, and I want to read those as well. Like, just because I said yes to one doesn't mean we just toss the other ones out and then, like, recommend new ones next time.
Oh, let's put it in the pot, because maybe, because What the Font is a one volume, and I don't feel like we would talk about it the whole time, perhaps.
Well, we probably will.
Yeah, we will. We're going real long.
I have a hunch.
Okay.
All right, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Thank you, listeners, for following us on this journey as we figure out our podcast. You've been listening to us review Delicious in Dungeon by Ryoko Kui, translated by Taylor Engel, lettered by Abigail Blackman, and published by Yen Press.
Oh, one more plug. She also has a book of short stories.
Oh, is that Seven Little Sons of the Dragon? Mm-hmm.
So seven short stories by the same author of Delicious in Dungeon. So
if you're not in for the big commitment, yeah, there you go.
That's a good one.
Definitely check that out. Does anyone have any other shout-outs? So then we can wrap it up and get out of here.
Oh, yeah, we were supposed to shout stuff out. I got nothing.
Chip, how about
you?
I've
been burying my head all week.
I've also got nothing.
What are we shouting out on?
Do you have anything?
Like, the stuff that we like or we're currently reading?
Anything. I'll take anything at this point.
Okay. I've been recommending Sweat and Soap to everybody. I really like this. It's a really lovely adult romantic comedy about a guy who has a great sense of smell and a girl who sweats a lot and is self-conscious about it. And somehow they find each other. It sounds super skeevy, but it's super sweet. I love it. It's from Kodansha by Kintetsu Yamada. I didn't recommend it to you because I didn't think you would be into mushy stuff.
Oh, but Chip loves sweat, so it would.
That's true. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You threw away your suggestion already. Yeah.
I will shout out, actually, the anime I mentioned Deb really liked that she introduced me to is Wakozake. Wakozake, I believe, unless I'm missing a syllable.
Wakakozake.
Wakako.
Zake is like sake. So Wakako and her sake.
It's a 12 episode anime series where each episode's only 2 minutes or so, give or take. And it's super cute. It's about a lady who goes to the bar after work, tries a beverage, has a bite to eat. One of the things I miss most about lockdown right now is traveling. And yeah, I would give anything to be in that anime for just a day, just to try delicious, you know, bar foods and have a beer too. So I'll relive it through my anime. So Wakako Zake, thank you, on Crunchyroll. And you could watch it for free if you're not in Canada.
I'm not sure if is the manga out in English yet?
There's a digital only on that one.
Cool. Thank you all for listening.
This has been Mangasplaining episode number 2, Delicious in Dungeon by Ryoko Kui, published by Yen Press. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Mermaid Saga by Rumiko Takahashi, published by Viz Media. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com. Thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from JELD-WEN. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on JELD-WEN windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save